The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at what might be the least celebrated aspect of human reproduction. We're joined by anthropology professor Kate Clancy to discuss menstruation, how it works, what it does to our bodies, and how it's been treated in medicine and myth. But first, let's learn about an interesting new evolutionary explanation for why it happens in the first place. I'm here with PZ Myers, biologist at the University of Minnesota Morris, an elite liberal arts college in rural western Minnesota. PZ lists his academic and research interests as evolution, development, the evolution of development, and the role of development in evolution. He also writes at his very widely read science blog, Pharyngula. Welcome to the show, sir.
Glad to be here.
You recently wrote a post about the evolution of menstruation in human females. So first off, maybe just give us a quick explanation of what menstruation actually is.
Well, I hope the ladies out there know. But yeah, what it is the uterine lining builds up every month. It thickens and prepares itself for implantation of an embryo in case an embryo comes along. And if an embryo does not come along, that extra thickened layer is shed. It's emitted as a kind of bloody mess through the vagina.
That was graphic. So we're speaking of a thickening of the endometrial tissue?
Yes, that's correct.
So a lot of aspects of reproduction are shared pretty widely by most mammals, like internal gestation and live birth and such. But menstruation itself only occurs in a few species, correct?
That's right. It's only seen in primates, most primates, a few species of bats, and the elephant shrew. And most other mammals, they don't do this bleeding stuff every month. It's just not what they do.
So then how do other mammals handle the need for the uterus to prepare for pregnancy?
Most of them seem much more sensible about it. What happens is that if an embryo comes tumbling down the fallopian tubes and is ready to implant, that embryo itself triggers the uterus to start thickening. So embryo first, then the thickening. In us humans, it's thickening first, and then possibly the embryo.
Well, then how do they shed the excess tissue?
They don't have to, because they're only going to do this if they're getting pregnant.
Right.
You only thicken the lining when you actually have an embryo there that will make you pregnant. And then, of course, during the period of gestation, you don't have to worry about it.
Well, as you said, that sounds a lot more convenient than
yes,
the
does.
Situation we have. Well, then from an evolutionary perspective, it seems that menstruation is kind of a liability, isn't it?
Maybe. The whole point of this interesting article was that they turned the question around and they said, you know, everybody asks, why do women menstruate? Why do they shed this lining? And the article asked and said, why do women build it up in the first place? And the answer is that we are a part of a species, a member of a species that has a particularly aggressive kind of embryo, that all of these species that have menstruation produce embryos that build this interface to the female circulatory system that's pretty elaborate, pretty dense, digs pretty deep into the uterus. And so what human women are doing is they are sort of producing a layer of armor to fend off the very aggressive embryo so it's got something it can implant in without getting too intimate with the uterine lining.
Well, there were a couple of reasons proposed for why menstruation could evolve, but they haven't really been satisfactory.
Right. The old question was, as I said, why do women bleed every month? Why do they shed this lining? And a couple of the other explanations were floating around was that, well, if they have sex, semen is a nasty substance. It introduces possible toxins. And so what they're basically doing is cleaning house. They're just flushing all the stuff they'd accumulated over the month out of the reproductive tract. That doesn't seem very likely since other species don't seem to need to do that. And they have semen and things like that, just like we do.
So tell us about this new paper that you mentioned. They mentioned something called decidualization.
Correct. Decidualization is the process of building up that thickened uterine lining. Other animals have triggered decidualization. That is, they respond to the presence of an embryo by thickening the lining.
Right.
We have spontaneous decidualization in which we're on a fairly regular monthly schedule in which it builds up whether there's an embryo present or not.
So why does it work one way with us and another way in other animals?
Why have we been cursed with this?
That's kind of what I'm getting at.
And the answer lies in the fact that there is a kind of evolutionary war going on between males and females. Males have one kind of evolutionary interest, which is to take advantage of the female, have her do all the work of producing a healthy baby that benefits his genetics because it will get passed on. And human males have a set of genes that are switched on fairly aggressively in development, and those male genes in the embryo try to make strong contact with the female circulatory system. We actually have a kind of implantation called hemochorial, which means that the extraembryonic membranes of the embryo dive deeply into the endometrial lining. They actually make contact directly with the woman's circulatory system, with the blood vessels in that area. Other species have epithelial chorial connections, for instance, which just means they just their embryos just sort of rest. They rest gently and delicately on the endometrial surface. They don't dig real deep. They can get their nutrients from the endometrium instead of going right to the woman's circulatory system.
Why did we get ripped off?
Oh, well, from some perspectives, you didn't get ripped off. You know, from the man's perspective, that means that he's got a more his embryos have a more reliable connection and are better at draining the lifeblood of the woman.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Evolution is not nice, okay? Evolution often does very insensitive, unkind things to people, and this is an example of it. Pregnancy is this difficult process where it's a trade-off between the embryo that wants to slurp up as many nutrients from mom as it can get, and mom, who would rather be cautious and hold off a little bit, you know, and she's interested in having this baby come to term too, but she doesn't want the baby to take up so much of her energy that she can't have more children or that this is a dangerous pregnancy. So there's this constant tug of war between the embryo and the mother. And in our species, some of the genes have pushed it in favor of the embryo, so the embryo is more aggressive. And then other genes, like these genes that trigger spontaneous decidualization, are things to protect the mother and give an advantage to her benefit.
So you're saying this is a self-defense measure?
Exactly. Because we have such greedy, grasping, you know, aggressive little parasitic embryos that would just love to chow down on everything mom produces. Mothers build an insulating layer so that, you know, the kid gets the nutrients it needs without taking over.
So you're saying that we menstruate because basically children are parasites.
They are not, strictly speaking, no, they're not parasites because they're, you know, they're our own species and it's sort of our advantage to have the children. But there are some parasitic aspects to it. The embryo is a little organism, a separate individual from the mother that is taking advantage of mom, that wants to get as much from her as it can get. And, you know, we know this is true even after they're born. That's what the way little kids are. You know, they want everything they can get from mom and dad as well. And you have to have some discipline and resist them. And this is just a biological example of that same principle.
I think I'm actually going to force my son to listen to this segment.
Yeah, he'll learn some lessons, right.
Thanks very much for being here, PZ.
It's been fun.
You can find a link to PZ Meyer's blog, Pharyngula, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Dr. Kate Clancy to talk more about menstruation and how it's been treated in medicine and myth after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at speak73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest today is Kate Clancy, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Illinois. She studies the evolutionary medicine of women's reproductive physiology and also blogs about her field, the evolution of human behavior, and issues for women in science at Context and Variation on scientificamerican.com. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to be discussing what science understands about menstruation, but we should probably start out by talking about all the things that we thought menstruation was. So, How has the perception of the period changed over the years?
That's such a great question. And in some ways, it's changed a lot, and in other ways, not so much. For a long time, I mean, I think a lot of us are aware of the fact that menses itself is kind of considered a dirty thing. It's considered gross. It's something people want to avoid. We have now all sorts of, you know, pads and tampons and things that are used to change a woman's scent while she's menstruating. So just in general, there's certainly a cultural aversion to it. But you can also trace this back when you look at the scientific history of the study of menstruation. All the way back to even when it was first studied, say in the Middle Ages, we have one of the most important texts that was used by medical doctors of that time was this book called De Sacratis Mulierum, Secrets of Women. And in that book, the literal translation of some of the lines in there are things like, woman is not human, but a monster. And so just in general, that text, I think, in a lot of ways has actually influenced how we continue to see menstruation because it was used for several centuries, even though it was written by someone who reportedly had never autopsied or studied women in any way at all. So it was kind of a completely made up text.
I find it interesting that the positions on menstruation tended to be quite extreme. It was either, as you said, really dirty and toxic and women had to be kept away from the rest of the group, or it was glorious and symbolic of nature and goddess-like and such. So why was there no middle ground?
I don't know. And I guess I just don't have the cultural anthro background to really say. What I do think is interesting is exactly what you're pointing out, and it's that, you know, people have very extreme views one way or the other, and it seems to me that menstruation itself seems like a very powerful thing. So maybe perhaps if your cultural views tend toward the patriarchal, you're going to see menstruation as something that is a negative power, you know, something that is dangerous. Whereas maybe if you are less patriarchal or more egalitarian, you might be more likely to celebrate it. And it seems like at least part of that is because to many of us, especially people who either don't have a lot of background in reproductive physiology or things like that, all you really see in terms of for day-to-day lives for women, or all you really learn about is that menstruation is sort of the most obvious external signal of cyclic fertility.
Right.
I mean, aside from when women are actually pregnant, you don't really see a lot about what it is that makes a woman fertile. And so I think for a lot of us, we've sort of attached this idea that menstruation is the symbol of fertility, though at the same time, it kind of isn't. It's a symbol that cycle, you know, if you are looking to get pregnant, then that cycle failed.
And science has come such a long way in terms of understanding menstruation. So do you think that to a certain extent that's been based on a changing culture?
At least partially, yes. I think that also whenever you have people that are from oppressed groups that are slowly able to enter into a field, then that changes the nature of the field. So when mostly men were doing science, there was one particular cultural perspective on, you know, the various things that they were studying. And then as more women became more involved, I'm sure that they were able to change that perspective. Same as, say, for instance, with the study of social disparities. And when you look at people from different classes or different ethnicities and how that has shaped our perspective on how we study the science of that.
You wrote a great post on something related to this on menotoxin.
That's one of my favorite stories, actually. Back when I was an undergraduate, I wrote a good chunk of my undergraduate thesis on this. And so I spent, and I wish more undergrads had this opportunity instead of just looking at things online. I just went to the Countway Medical Library at Harvard, and I would just sit on the floor in the basement with tons of Lancet journals all spread around me. And I was just pouring through by hand, trying to find all these old letters, because most of the study of menotoxins were done entirely through letters in Lancet. It's just, for whatever reason, that's where most of the publications were. So the story that I saw was that the originator of this hypothesis, his name was Dr. Bela Schick, and this was back in the 20s. It's reported that he was a very popular doctor and all of his patients adored him. And so, of course, he received flowers all the time. And one day he received flowers, as of course he always was because he was so popular, and he handed them to his nurse and said, "Go put these in water for me." And she, you know, withdrew and said, "No, I don't want to. Maybe ask somebody else." And he said, "No, you know, woman, go do this." And who knows why she said no, but the reason she eventually gave him after he pushed her pretty hard about it was, "Well, I'm menstruating right now, and I've found that when I touch flowers that they wilt at my touch." So, of course, he sees this as an opportunity for scientific study and decides to force her to handle them. And when she handled them, they wilted. So he, of course, underwent a very rigorous study after that point, where he very carefully put some flowers in water and then had a menstruating woman handle some flowers and put them in water. And then the flowers that were handled wilted, and the flowers that were delicately put, you know, very carefully into a vase without being handled did not. With the way that I told the story, you can kind of tell there are some confounders there, like handling roughly versus just carefully putting something in. But that's where the whole thing started. And that's where people got this idea that there was something toxic in, you know, in the sweat of menstruating women. And what I find interesting is nobody really thought about why that would be meaningful. Like, why would a woman produce a toxin that would make a flower wilt? Is there an evolutionary reason for this, an adaptive one? Like, especially with women as foragers, if you really want to play that card, women are the one handling all the plant matter for their family. So if they're making things wilt whenever they're menstruating, that seems like, you know, just from an adaptive perspective, a really bad move. And yet this idea persisted for a really long time. And there were almost no well-controlled studies, just lots of really bad studies. And all of these bad studies basically did not really show that menotoxins existed. But the idea persisted well into the 70s, and even I think the most recent time I saw them cited was as most recent as 2003. So people love this idea.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking about menstruation with Kate Clancy, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Illinois. So maybe to give everybody a background, what is menstruation's role in reproduction?
Menstruation doesn't really have a role in reproduction. And that's kind of the funny thing about it. What it is leftover blood and tissue that you didn't use to make a baby in that previous cycle. Menstruation is something that not a lot of species have, but no one has it to the copious degree that humans have it. Even if you look at forager societies, you know, ones that aren't as well-fed and sedentary as, you know, those of us talking right now. And so what it seems to be the case is that we have all this excess endometrial lining that we need to get rid of because we can't quite resorb it at all. We make so much because we want this really, really lush place for the trophoblast to implant. So that's sort of the fertilized egg as it's making its way down the fallopian tube. It's kind of looking for somewhere to implant. And it wants the luscious place with the most sort of nooks and crannies, you know, like a Thomas's English muffin. That's basically how I like to describe the endometrium.
That was beautiful.
So the thing is they're looking for this beautiful, lush place, and it finds it in implants. And the thing with humans is we have the most invasive trophoblast invasion of any species. So that trophoblast burrows way, way, way in there, really deep, so that there are very few layers of cells between the mother and the fetus. And that's a really interesting thing for a lot of ways. It means the fetus is trying to exert, in some ways, a lot of control over how much resource it gets. And it also means that the fetus probably needs a lot of resource. And a lot of people seem to think that this is related to the fact that we have really big brains and our fetuses need lots of extra nutrients for that reason.
So that's lovely for people who desire children. The ones that don't, how does the pill affect menstruation?
It seems to vary. The pill, or a hormonal contraceptive that you'd sort of take by mouth, for most women in industrialized populations, so again, you know, those in the U.S. and Canada who are fairly urban or suburban living and are, say, adults, so, you know, in their 20s or older, the amount of hormone in the pill is probably less than what they normally produce. So over time, what the pill should do, if they're taking that placebo week that gives them sort of a, that gives them a period, is that their period should actually become lighter over time because they're not putting as much hormone into making that endometrium big and lush. But however, there are a lot of instances for adolescent girls who, for whom the amount of hormone in the pill might actually be a little too high, or women in developing populations, or, you know, agricultural, rural, forager mm-hmm. populations. When they take the pill, they experience a lot of negative side effects and breakthrough bleeding. And again, that's because the amount of hormone for them is actually a little high for their population.
Now, some methods of birth control actually suppress menstruation altogether. So how do they work?
The way they work is more by providing a continuous amount of hormone. So Depo-Provera is one example. So that's a shot that you get about every 3 months. And it's one shot of progesterone, I think in oil. And what that does is it kind of gives you one big bolus of progesterone all at once. That's the hormone that maintains the endometrium through the implantation window, so around when implantation would be occurring. And it's also a pregnancy hormone, so it kind of mimics pregnancy during that time. So the body is like, well, I shouldn't be allocating to the endometrium right now. So for those women, if you actually time the shot right for every 3 months, you basically can just not get a period anymore. Other examples are you can take hormonal contraceptives by mouth, so you can take the pill, but just skip the placebo week or take the preparations that already kind of skip that placebo week for you. And then the final example is the hormonal IUD, like Mirena, which is a very small amount of hormone that really only acts locally on the uterus. While a lot of women experience some spotting and a little discomfort at the very beginning of getting an IUD, after that, many, many women completely lose their period while on the IUD.
Well, is that safe? Complete suppression of menstruation?
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason to remove the endometrium unless you're trying to restart your cycle. So, you know, there's nothing necessarily bad about not having a period.
Have there been long-term studies done on that?
That's the tricky part. And I don't really know that there have been. It would certainly satisfy me a little bit more if there had been. But certainly off the top of my head, I don't see anything wrong with it. The issue for me is not so much, is there anything wrong with not having a period? It's, is there anything wrong with that having one more week of hormone because you're skipping a placebo week than you would ordinarily? Right. And so for that, there are lots of conflicting studies. So I'm not saying this is 100% a problem for everyone, but in some studies in some populations, they found that the birth control pill actually does increase the risk of breast cancer. And the reason for that is not because there's anything inherently bad about contraception, but that if you're increasing your estrogen exposure, particularly in preparations that have higher amounts of estrogens, you know, normally it's 3 of the 4 weeks that have estrogen because that one placebo week has nothing in it. So if you're then doing 4 of 4, then you're increasing the amount of estrogen you're exposed to by a fair bit. So if you're already at risk for breast cancer, and again, there are some studies that have shown this and some studies that haven't, but if you already are at risk for other genetic reasons, for me, that would be a reason to worry. So not so much about the menstruation, but about the estrogen exposure.
We have a question from Kristen.
Why are most birth control pills designed to allow a woman to still have a period, especially when research is showing that there is no need to have a period at all?
That is such a great question. My understanding of it, of sort of the history of how the pill came about, is that the original designers of the pill thought that women would feel uncomfortable if they didn't have one. For many women, the presence of the period is, if you're looking to not get pregnant, a source of relief, right? Phew, dodged another bullet, you know? And so if
that's a really good point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, if any of you have been in that position before where you do not want to get pregnant, but you are sexually active with a man, then that is a source of relief. And so if you're using contraception and you do not want to get pregnant, that presence of the period is very comforting. Like, okay, good. I don't need to, you know, check this in any other way. I can trust that this period is telling me something. So it seems to be that a lot of they were worried that women would not want to lose their period.
So is there any physical advantage to menstruation if a woman doesn't want to have children?
No, I guess not. I mean, personally,
I just heard angels. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it really depends on people's experiences of it. Because here's the thing is that painful periods, you can get them a lot more in adolescence. So when you first start getting your period, you actually get it a lot less frequently. It's called adolescent subfecundity. So it's actually normal in the first anywhere from 5 to 12 years after you first get your period So that's anywhere from like when you're 10 to 14 years of age or so, right? So for 5 to 12 years after the point, it's actually normal to have irregular periods, so to not get your period every month. And that's something a lot of women don't realize, that that's actually normal in the beginning. The other thing that's unfortunately normal is that it's more painful when you're an adolescent than when you're older. Now, if you are, say, an adolescent who has had irregular periods and they're very painful, and then you go to your doctor and say, I have irregular painful periods, and then she or he puts you on the pill, then you don't ever get through that point of those very painful periods
right.
to where they actually become a little less painful. And then maybe you can start to deal with them a little bit better. And so you always have this perception like periods are awful. That's not to discount some very painful, uncomfortable experiences that many, many women experience. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, in a really big way. But I think it's also important to acknowledge the ways in which if you take the pill through a huge part of your adolescent and early adult years, that actually changes how you experience and understand your own body.
I have so many questions that lead from that. First of all, can you tell me sort of the physiological, I don't know, why does it hurt? Why physically is it painful?
You know, it's funny. I'm actually just starting to do some research to write a blog post on exactly that question.
Interesting.
So I can give you the beginnings of what I've been reading about, but
great.
Not a ton. The big culprit is prostaglandins, which are a substance that induces contractions in your body. Another substance would be oxytocin that does that. So basically, your uterus, actually throughout your menstrual cycle, is experiencing something called endometrial waves, where your entire uterus is pulsating from one end to the other. It actually happens all cycle long, but at certain points in the cycle, it's going in one direction. So at points in your cycle where you want to keep things out, the wave sort of starts at the top of the uterus and goes down. At other points, like around ovulation or just after ovulation, when you potentially want to invite something in to get pregnant, it shifts and the wave goes from the cervix to the fundus and starts waving up,
sort of
like sucking things up in a way. Now, the thing is, though, is when you have menses, of course, it's going down, right? And what's happening is instead of those really mild waves that happen all cycle long and are totally normal, you have more, you know, you have more waves and they're needing to happen a bit more strongly to actually get menses out. And so those contractions can be painful. The other issue is that all women who've menstruated have at least some tiny, tiny bit of endometriosis, regardless of whether you're diagnosed with it or not. And for the most part, that doesn't mean you should do anything about it, but just there's always a little of upsuck that happens. So, you know, a little bit of menstrual tissue that actually goes back into your body rather than being flushed out. And it'll attach to different parts in your abdomen. And so then when you have hormonal signals that are telling you to contract or telling you to flush things out, you have little parts all over your uterus, I mean, all over your abdomen that are potentially getting that signal. And so the pain from that signal can broaden from not just your uterus to all of your body. And then, of course, it also hits your bowel. So the prostaglandins that contract your uterus, they're not just targeted just at your uterus. They do things like contract your bowels, which is why women get diarrhea around this time. So just in general, all that contraction can kind of make all your abdominal organs a little mad at you.
Now, we have a few audience questions that really want to follow up on the suppression of menstruation issue. From Ginny.
Is there a strong consensus about whether or not birth control that eliminates your period is really safe or not?
A question like that would probably be better answered by someone who's like an obstetrician gynecologist themselves. So within the because they interface with medical doctors more often. And in anthropology and other related sciences where we study human biology, we're not very good at getting consensus, I guess you could say, or we're not going to put together a position statement that sort of states our consensus. But if I had to guess, at sort of what my colleagues, you know, if we decided to sit around a table and say, all right, let's see how we feel about this. I would say probably most people would think it's fine in terms of its safety. Again, from a perspective of whether avoiding menstruation is safe. I think there are still some questions about whether continuous hormones or high amounts of hormone exposure is safe, but certainly in terms of it affecting. So that's why, for instance, you know, I have no qualms at all about say an IUD suppressing menstruation because the amount of hormone is very small. But at least personally, a little bit more when you use a hormonal birth control pill to do it.
And a related question from Kat.
How might stopping your period affect the onset of menopause, if at all?
It shouldn't, but it's a very interesting question. Now, from what I've read, a lot of studies, the few studies that have done any long-term looks at the birth control pill, their idea of long-term is 10 years. The number of years that women actually use the birth control pill often exceeds that.
Quite a bit longer, right.
Yeah, so, I mean, think about a girl who, say, starts at 13 because she has irregular periods and thinks that that's abnormal. Then she hits her 20, you know, then she hits her late teens or 20s and becomes sexually active. So, of course, she's going to stay on it. Then she goes into her 30s and she might briefly go off it to have children and then go back on it again. Or, you know, but she could have basically most of her reproductive years on the pill. What I wonder is sort of the feedback loop of how your body responds to hormone, whether if you're getting a different value externally because of a pill you're taking than whatever your body would naturally produce. I wonder if that... I wonder what that would do. I don't think it would really do anything major, but I think it's an interesting question.
I'm going to put money on you writing posts about this.
Yes, I think I'm going to have to.
Okay, so back to the questions that sort of led from what you were talking about. You were mentioning irregular periods and such. So what is a normal period then?
You know, a normal period is just about any period that a woman has, like any sort of cycle length that a woman has fairly consistently in her life, which for some women is every 27 days. For some women, it's every 35. Some women, every 60 days or so, and who cares because I'm not looking to have a kid right now.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so there's a huge amount of variation, and much of that variation is totally normal because it has everything to do with how one responds to environment. So my particular field within anthropology is called reproductive ecology. And it's trying to understand how environment affects reproductive physiology. And so if you are really stressed, and I mean in terms of just the physiological stress response, so it could be psychosocial stress, immunological stress, energetic stress. If you are very stressed, that is probably going to disrupt reproductive function. And so instead of you having that textbook 28-day cycle, you could end up with a shorter or longer one as a result. But that's actually adaptive. So that's not abnormal. That's actually right. Quite adaptive.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to talk more about menstruation with Kate Clancy after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about strange life forms that stretch our assumptions about the natural world. Molecular pharmacologist David Kroll returns to tell us about fungi and their amazing uses, from necessities like bread and beer to medical and environmental breakthroughs. And we're joined by Sarah Matthews, principal investigator at the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University, to discuss a new study that used genetic techniques to overturn the popular conception of cycads as living fossils. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Kate Clancy, assistant professor of anthropology who blogs about women's reproductive physiology, the evolution of human behavior, and women in science at Context and Variation on scientificamerican.com. So let's talk about something that I hear a lot about, menstrual synchronicity, the idea mm-hmm. that when women spend a lot of time together, their cycles sync up.
So
anywhere you want to go with that.
Yeah. Oh, so many places I could go. The thing about menstrual synchrony, there are so many interesting things about it. To me, just from a broader perspective, the idea of menstrual synchrony is one of those ideas that seems so intuitive that we really want to believe it. But then when we interrogate it a little bit more, it seems like it's really just not there. And the reasons that we want to believe it are many. For some, it might be because they really want to believe that women are just ruled by their reproductive biology. And for others, it's because they feel like they've experienced it in their lives. Right. Most women I've talked to, this is one of the first things they ask me about because they've said, I totally synchronized when I was at Girl Scout camp, or I totally synchronized with my friend whose locker was next to mine. But what they were really seeing was just a menstrual onset that was kind of close, which isn't the same as synchronized. Right. So just happening sometimes to have a period that overlaps with your friend is not synchrony. And so that's sort of where the intuitive idea came from.
Well, there have been studies about this, though, correct? I'm thinking about the series of articles and letters in the Journal of Comparative Psychology.
Yes. So, well, there are a couple of things that we could look at. One is that there have actually been studies of primates related to us, of old world monkeys, that have looked at this. And so in those studies, they found basically nothing. Like they've had 10 years worth of data and looked for synchrony in them and found absolutely none. Even in species where there was some adaptive reason you might expect to see synchronicity, you still just don't see it. But within the ones that you're talking about with the Journal of Comparative Psychology, what's funny about that is that there seems to have been a little bit of a fight among a couple of different researchers. And so there's this one guy who's completely anti, completely anti-menstrual synchrony, and then two other groups that are pro-menstrual synchrony, and they just kind of fought it out and made fun of each other and were kind of rude over a couple of years in the early 2000s. And so it's actually kind of fun to go back and read those, kind of like what I was saying with the menotoxins ones. You can just go back and read the letters and just see these people. It's kind of like early blogs, you know, fuming at each other over these little letters that seem to mean so much to them. But just to briefly say what the criticisms were about is one of them is that the mechanism for menstrual synchrony is supposedly pheromone detection. And we can't seem to figure out what pheromone could possibly be doing this, let alone a mechanism that allows us to detect pheromones.
And let me interrupt for a second, because I thought humans didn't have pheromones.
We probably have pheromones, but I don't know that we have a way to detect them.
Oh, right.
And that's kind of the funny thing is that on the one hand, we probably do. So pheromones are just, basically, it's a hormone in the air. And since we are full of hormones, I'm sure hormones get secreted in the air all the time. Pheromones are also odorless, which is another thing people sometimes forget. So we might have preferences for smell, for odor, but pheromones don't have odor. So just to make sure that sort of that distinction is made. One thing is that at least, you know, when I talk to people who know more about this than I do, they're pretty insistent that the vomeronasal organ, which is what many other species use to detect pheromones, is completely non-functional in humans. And so the most important mechanism or the biggest mechanism for how we would detect pheromones doesn't even seem to work in humans. So that seems to be at least the first strike against menstrual synchrony. The other one, of course, being that not a single controlled study, well-controlled study, has actually ever found synchrony. They've found maybe low synchrony scores, kind of like the anecdotal stuff I was telling you where like right. One girl gets her period and then 2 days later her friend gets her period. But again, that's not the same thing as actual synchrony.
Would it have been beneficial for females to have evolved to have the same menstrual cycle?
Well, I'm not really sure why they would be. If you think about it, there are a lot of reasons for that. Just to back up even more. So we're used to women menstruating somewhere around every month. And we have this idea that that's what women do, right? But if you actually look at how we evolved, we probably evolved to be foragers. We probably had at least somewhat marginal environments. So we probably got enough to eat, but we had to work pretty hard as well. And we did not have very many forms of contraception. We might have had the occasional way of stimulating abortion, but we certainly didn't have birth control pills or condoms. And so we were pregnant or lactating most of the time. So that meant we were only getting maybe 50 periods over our entire reproductive lives. And when you consider those big, long bouts of pregnancy and lactation, how often are two people ever actually not pregnant and lactating and cycling normally enough to ever have any periods of synchrony? So from an evolutionary perspective, you just think about how it is that we lived and how it was how we actually were having lots of periods of pregnancy and lactation. It just doesn't make sense for us to ever have done that.
Well, actually, there's a lot of interesting theories around the evolution of menstruation.
Mm.
Is there any that you particularly want to talk about?
I mean, the first one is, of course, menotoxins, the one that we've already talked about, that there's this horrible toxin secreted in women's sweat and menses, and that basically menstruation is to help rid her of these horrible toxins. So just to get the bad out, to get clean every month. After that, what's kind of fun to me is when you try to follow the history of how people have studied this and looked at the evolution of menstruation, other hypotheses that happened after menotoxins actually still had some of the same embedded ideas or embedded cultural ideas that menstruation must be about ridding something bad. And that's not to say that's not understandable, right? Because it's something leaving your body, periodically. So it makes sense. But, one of the more popular ideas in the 90s was that it was to eliminate unwanted embryos. So kind of a form of miscarriage. My favorite actually is Margie Proffitt's. So she had this idea of the sperm-borne pathogen. So she basically, she completely turned the tables on the idea of the menotoxin. So instead of it women having something dirty they had to expel from their body because they were inherently dirty, men were the dirty ones because they had these pathogens riding their sperm and women had to get rid of it every month.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so basically it's men's fault. That was kind of her idea. And so again, I love the idea, but it's really not supported in evidence because right. You don't see more menstruation with more promiscuity, which is one thing that you would expect to see. So if women are having more sexual partners and potentially being more exposed to pathogens, you'd see more menstruation. That doesn't bear out. If you look at even phylogenetic relatedness, it still just doesn't quite bear out. And also, if you were to just think about, well, would you really want to design something where you got rid of pathogens only once a cycle? That doesn't seem like a good idea either, especially given the fact, like I said, if you only did it 50 times in your whole life instead of, say, every month, you know, instead of 400 times, it just doesn't seem like a very efficient way to get rid of pathogens.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm on the line with Kate Clancy, assistant professor of anthropology and blogger at scientificamerican.com. We're talking about the fact and fiction surrounding menstruation. Now we have a bunch of audience questions to get to, and we will tackle as many as we can on air. But Kate has been kind enough to agree to answer any that we don't get to on her blog. From Chris.
What effect does diet and activity have on menstruation?
So I love that question because that is sort of the bread and butter of my field of study, reproductive ecology, is how is it that what we eat and how we move around impact our reproductive physiology? And it seems like, you know, over the last couple of decades, we have some pretty straightforward answers for this one. And the biggest punchline is the more you move around and the less you eat, the lower your hormone concentrations. And most likely also, though there's less evidence for this just because people have studied it less, but probably the lighter your periods as well. So there have been a few studies that have looked at women where they do a very slight calorie restriction diet, just enough to lose about 1 pound a week, and found that if they do that, women's hormone levels go down significantly. Other studies that have taken sedentary women and put them on very, very mild exercise regimes, so only running about 5 miles a week, and have also found that that suppresses hormone levels. So even tiny amounts of activity change can actually have profound impacts on our hormones. We don't always see that in terms of menstrual cycle length or the amount that you menstruate, but I think it's still really interesting that that actually does end up having an impact on your hormones.
Well, maybe this is a good point to bring up something that I've heard repeatedly also. There's a link between menstruation and iron deficiency. Is that correct?
No.
Good.
What's great about that question is that that's a very strongly held belief that if you menstruate, that you are simply more at risk for becoming deficient in iron. And this comes from the fact that there is a sex difference in iron status, and this that it begins at puberty. So it would be natural at first to assume that since that sex difference, where men end up having higher iron stores around puberty than women, that it must be because around puberty is when women begin to menstruate. However, the other thing that happens at puberty is that men's testosterone goes up. And testosterone promotes oxygen transport and helps with iron stores. And so actually, it's not necessarily that women's iron stores go down appreciably once they start menstruating, but that men's iron stores go up quite a bit once they hit puberty. So that's sort of the first line of evidence that made me pause and say, I guess this menses thing isn't really quite as evil as we thought. The next thing is that I actually decided, I kind of did some research on this on my own when I was doing my dissertation back in 2005 is when I did my dissertation research at the Mogilica Human Ecology Study Site in rural Poland. And what I found is that if you look at women's endometrial thickness and their dietary iron, so how much iron they're ingesting, as well as their own red blood count and hemoglobin counts. What we found is that dietary iron didn't really seem to have any correlation with endometrial thickness, but hemoglobin and red blood count both had a positive association. So the thicker your endometrium, the better your iron status, as opposed to worse. And the assumption would have been, right, that if menstruation is causing iron deficiency anemia, that you'd see the reverse. And so to me, what we're seeing here is just that, you know, if you have enough energy to have thicker endometria and thus probably a heavier period, you probably also have enough energy to store enough iron in your body. So this is sort of a marker of positive health.
Interesting.
Now, this is, of course, within the range of normal. So, you know, there are absolutely women who have menorrhagia. So that's, say, losing more than 120 milliliters a cycle. And for those women, yes, iron deficiency anemia is absolutely correlated with menses. But for women who have a normal amount, it really doesn't seem to be the case.
We have a question from the chat from Cy Curious.
Why do some women get cravings around menstruation? Is there a biological reason for that?
Oh, Saya, such a good question.
Though,
you know, she is actually probably more equipped to answer that one than I am. I don't know that there really is a lot of data to help us understand this. There are a couple of things that are important to notice about the premenstrual phase. So that phase of, you know, say 7 to 10 days or so before you menstruate. The most important thing is that your hormones are going down at this point. So in fact, for those couple of days before you get your period and then into those first few days of your period, if anything, your hormone profile is more male than female. Like you have low hormone levels.
Right.
So all of that, all of the criticisms people make of, oh, you must be PMSing right now. Well, actually, no, I'm actually just more male right now. So thanks for criticizing me for my behavior when actually I'm just acting more like you. So for one, what we're seeing at that premenstrual period is hormones that are declining. Now, it seems like that decline in hormone produces withdrawal in some women. And we don't totally understand why some women are more sensitive to that withdrawal than others. But the sensitivity that, to that withdrawal may produce some negative behaviors or depressive behaviors. And sometimes those are associated with cravings. So we don't totally understand the biology around it yet, and we don't understand why some women are more sensitive than others. The one other thing that might be going on is that chocolate cravings, for instance, this is something Cy and I have talked about before, is chocolate cravings may in some way make sense around that time because of the fact that cannabinoids are potentially higher around the implantation window, because it just so happens that one of the signals to the conceptus to implant happens to be a cannabinoid itself. And so maybe as you're experiencing withdrawal from all of that, you're craving something, and actually there are cannabinoids in chocolate. So, you know, that's obviously pure conjecture, but it's one of the nice stories I like to tell myself to excuse the large amount of chocolate that I do consume from time to time.
Okay, now this next question is possibly my most favorite question that I have ever received on this show.
Okay.
From Jay.
I've always been told not to go camping while I'm having a period because the smell of blood will attract predators. While it kind of makes sense, I'm wondering if there's any truth to it.
It's a fantastic question.
It is a fantastic question, and it turns out there are actually studies that have looked at this, which is not something I knew until very recently. So the way I first started looking, exploring the answer to this, I found first a study, interestingly, an American anthropologist. So there were anthropologists out there, my people, in the early 80s, trying to figure out whether menstrual odor was in some way a problem when you're out camping.
God, I love science.
And mostly what they were curious about was whether it's an aversive for game animals. So does the odor of a menstruating woman make game run away so that you can't shoot and kill it and eat it?
Right.
And so there were some very funny, very poorly controlled studies that happened in the 80s where these people would go to and where there were deer that were in pens, and then they would give them, and I kid you not, this is what they called it. They did not explain how they did this, menstrually scented feed, and then feed that had the scent simply of human urine. And they put out the menstrually scented feed and the urinally scented feed and see which one they wanted to eat. And they preferred to eat the urinally scented feed. So they decided that meant that it was an aversive for deer.
Hmm.
Follow-up studies found that if they put men's blood on deer feed, the exact same thing happened, though, that they were at an aversive to the men's blood as well. So it might be that they're eating blood as opposed to eating that they had a problem with menstrual blood. Now, that doesn't totally answer, of course, the caller's question, because their worry is probably more about attacks, right? Not just, you know, are deers going to run away at the smell of menstruation, but are bears going to come running at the smell? And so it actually turns out that in the Journal of Wildlife Management in 1991, there was a study that looked at this in free-living black bears. So they put out a bunch of tampons, like just plain unused tampons as a control, and then tampons with menses on them as a non, you know, as to see if menstrual odor was a problem, mm-hmm. and observed whether these free living black bears would come up to it and have a problem with it or charge it or get excited or whatever. And they basically didn't react. They just kind of didn't care one way or the other. Which I find kind of funny. You know, if you were, can you imagine being a researcher with your little notebook and watching a bear come up and either ignore or inspect a tampon? I mean, it's kind
of
a...
You are killing me.
It would be a pretty fun study. But then the other thing that that same study pointed out in the Journal of Wildlife Management is that there, at least at the time of that study in 91, there was not a single recorded attack of a black bear on a menstruating woman. Not a single one. And there have certainly been bear attacks. So, you know, so far in the literature, it, at least from what I've found, it doesn't seem to support, you know, that bears are drawn to menstrual blood. And we also don't seem to really have good evidence that it is necessarily making, if you're a hunter and you're out camping, that it's necessarily an aversive, though blood itself may be an aversive in some way. So it's kind of hard to say.
Oh, I love that question. Thank you, Jay, too. Whoever you are. Here's one from Leanne.
When I was young, we were bombarded with warnings about getting toxic shock syndrome from tampons. You don't hear about it much anymore. How dangerous is it, or was it?
Well, it certainly was very dangerous for those very few women who did get it. Toxic shock syndrome is a pretty serious thing. What happens is, basically, if you keep a tampon, especially one of very high absorbency, in your body for a pretty long period of time, it seemed to be the perfect condition to grow Staphylococcus aureus. And when that is able to grow, it seems to produce this toxin. It's like a bacterial superantigen. And that bacterial superantigen would be produced and overactivate the T cells in your body. And that would result in this massive cytokine release, and essentially an overloaded immune system seems to be the cause for a lot of the really awful symptoms that women would get with toxic shock syndrome. Now, that said, what I was saying about long-term use or higher absorbency, you know, there's kind of mixed results for that. But in general, that seemed to be what freaked people out the most, is that the particular, potentially the kinds of bleaches used in tampons, the rate of absorbency and how long they are in the body seem to all be risk factors. Now, that said, one study I found in 1980 found that the incidence was about 6.2 per 100,000 in the United States. So we're looking at a fairly low incidence, but that doesn't mean that it's not serious. Now, my understanding is that at least the dye and the absorbency issue is largely resolved in modern tampons, and they certainly do make tampons now that are advertised as safe for overnight use. Right. So my impression, I wouldn't say 100% for sure, but my impression is that a lot of the things that seem to make tampons such a lovely home for the Staphylococcus aureus have been mostly negated.
This question is from David.
Can you speak about the theory that reducing the amount of menstrual periods a woman experiences reduces the risk of reproductive cancers?
That's a great question. It depends on which cancer we're talking about, and it depends on the mechanism that you're actually using to reduce menses. So again, if we're talking about the pill, and you're reducing menses by skipping the placebo week and taking more hormones, then you might be reducing certain kinds of cancer. So birth control pills, for instance, in many cases stop ovulation. And a lot of people seem to think that frequent ovulations are part of what can lead to ovarian cancer, because the more times you have that rupture of the follicle and that repair mechanism, the more chances you have for mutation of some kind occurring. So, you know, stopping ovulation certainly seems to be a good thing. Stopping endometrial cycling when you are at risk of endometrial cancer, same sort of a thing. If you're not constantly having this repair process, this growth and repair process happening over and over again, that certainly seems to reduce risk of those cancers. But again, for breast cancer, it seems to be something that would worry me a little bit, again, if the mechanism is the birth control pill, because again, in some women and some studies, you do see an increased risk for breast cancer.
We have so many audience questions. Let's go with this. Mm-hmm. From John.
What's up with PMS?
I don't know, John. What is up with PMS?
That's broad.
It is, and I'm sort of struggling to figure out what he might mean by that. And so maybe I'll back up and sort of say a little bit more about what I was saying about PMS before, is that, for one, premenstrual syndrome is a very weird thing. Women in general seem to get stuck with a lot of syndromes. And a syndrome is usually a suite of symptoms that occur, that the doctors have seen and clinicians have seen occur together often enough in women that they think it must be a thing, but they don't know what's causing the thing.
Right.
So they call it a syndrome. So that means they don't necessarily understand the origin, but what that also means is they could be looking at, say, three different diseases, but they're lumping it into one. So another good example would, say, be polycystic ovarian syndrome. There are probably at least three different ways you can get that, but we call everyone who has it, you know, someone with PCOS. So that's one thing. PMS is kind of a messy diagnostic because lots of women could have it at any given time, but is it meaningful and what's the origin? You know, that's really iffy. And in fact, PMS itself, you know, anywhere from, you know, 5 to 30% of women could have it. But it's just such a diffuse definition that it's hard to really say much about it. Now that said, what it probably has something to do with is the fact that that withdrawal of hormone from the body over the couple of days leading up to menstruation, seems to evoke certain feelings in some women. So the withdrawal in particular of progesterone, which is an anti-anxiolytic, could produce feelings of anxiety. So, you know, if you have a happy drug and then you don't have a happy drug anymore, you might not feel so good.
Right.
So that seems to be at least part of what's going on with PMS. And, you know, there a lot of people are really into looking at GABA receptors in the brain and allopregnanolone and things like that. And these are just things, basically, all of this is related to progesterone, that we know that something about progesterone is relevant here. We just don't totally understand what that is.
How about from Gina K72?
Could you ask your guest to comment on the study mentioned in an article from the Huffington Post titled "Menstruation and Women's Voices: Can Men Hear You When You Have Your Period?"
My opinion is that I'm kind of aligned with the person who wrote the HuffPo article, that I'm not totally excited about the results. And part of the reason for that is something that's actually come up earlier in our conversation, and it's that we might menstruate and we might have this idea that it's normal to menstruate 400 times over our lives, but that's not necessarily normal to what our ancestors would have experienced. Our ancestors at most menstruated, say, 50 times, maybe 100 times if they didn't get pregnant and lactated too much. So the problem is that all of this obsession with trying to understand variation in behavior over the menstrual cycle is paying attention to a part of ancestral women's lives that hardly ever occurred. So to me, if you really want to understand variation in menstrual cycling, variation in behavior or attractiveness or whatever of women through the menstrual cycle, you can't just study menstruating women. You also have to have controls for pregnant women and lactating women, because that's the much more common state. And I did read the original paper. I managed to give it a quick read before this, and they did not do that. And so for me, I mean, yeah, sure, it's interesting that, you know, that men were able 35% of the time to detect menstruation and that they found the voices of menstruating women less attractive. But one, I question whether that's meaningful. And two, I question what the results would have been if they'd also looked at pregnant and lactating women.
So we are completely out of time, and I know there are many, many more questions, which I will forward to you, and I'm sure there will be a resulting blog post, but is there anything that we've missed? Is there anything that you'd like to leave people with?
Not really. Just that, as cool, you know, I study, obviously, reproduction and women's reproduction, and I think that that's really cool. But one of the things that I think it's also important for people to understand is that even though we have such a focus and such an interest on menstruation itself, there are a lot of other really, really cool things that happen inside the female body, and we just don't see them. You know, the variation in hormones, the variation in things that happen at the placenta or the endoplacental interface. And my hope is that maybe some of these people that are listening in and learning more about menstruation and periods, maybe we'll also get to learn a little bit more about some of those other things as well.
Kate, it was great to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
You can find links to Kate Clancy on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to Google+, so that you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program, listen to past episodes, or write what I'm sure will be a wonderful review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.